radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Time, but space is a place that only a human being located. Where there's so much information to take, then you enter an entirely new place. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
African people have given to the world the deepest sense of soul power. Whether we are continental or diasporic Africans, our culture, body movement, musical expression, language, values, and spiritual expression reflect highly developed creation. Our past reveals the divine nature of our beings, kingdoms and queendoms where the spirit of the land was inseparable from the spirit of the people. As we move into the 21st century, let us move with Africa's grace and nobility, allowing our bodies to be vehicles for the spirit to manifest its beauty and creativity. It is essential for any complete healing process to move from the inside out. As the only true destruction comes from the inside out, the only true healing begins internally and moves out. Africans throughout the world have all the resources necessary to heal themselves and become whole again. It will take the collaboration of mind power, economic power, physical power, and most importantly, spiritual power to complete the circle of health. There must be a movement on all fronts, cleansing the body of the toxins we consume, creating education centers to kill the slave mentality and allow our genius to surface and develop. Financing companies that produce our own clothing, our own appliances, our own food. 2000 Black is about reaching into the past to pull forth the greatness of the ancestors, those whose very lives were celebrations of life, fertility, and soul. We in this new age of artificiality and materialism have mastered the art of making a living, but have no real idea as to how to live. Similarly, we are so busy ripping and running to make our deadlines that we have forgotten how to listen to our lifelines. As we begin to rediscover our lifelines, we find the child inside, clutching the solution. This is why the most important resource we have is our youth. They are our geniuses, our jewels, our untouched God power. Crucial to our survival in the 21st century is the development of our children. 2000 Black is a plan to bring forth that divinity that already exists inside of us. It is an expression of real purpose and truth. It is a movement towards the attainment of complete freedom, as we understand that freedom is love, is freedom. 2000 Black is a spiritual unity, as it works to develop sound individual universes that shall inevitably connect back into the one universe from which we all came. 2000 Black is a salute to the ancestors, the children, the earth, and the God force inside of every spirit.
Professor Griff, you're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griff from Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. On the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul, my name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. We started off our program with Ayanna Gregory, 2000 Black theme, and we hope that sets the stage for our guest, Professor Manu Ampem, who's a historian, primary researcher, a director, advancing the research. He's an author, and he is a relatively familiar figure here on Rainbow Soul. He hosted a program for many, many years, Africana Studies, and it's a pleasure to have him as a guest. We'll speak with him following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. Stay tuned.
Greetings to the Internet Radio family. This is Reverend Valentine speaking. You know, for nearly 30 years, I have had the distinct experience of being interviewed over every medium of communication available to the public. And except for the metaphysical underground, I can think of no other electronic venue that has been more progressive, more innovative, more insightful, more diligent, more diverse in its demographics, and more courageously supportive of the truth than this ever-growing phenomenon called Internet radio. And this is precisely why I'm here to tell you that it is so vital that you give your wholehearted support to it. Tell a friend. In fact, tell 2, 3, and 4 of your friends. If you are a business owner, support Internet radio by telling your customers and constituents all about it. Let them know that there is a legitimate and important substitute to all of the prefabricated, super-sensitive garbage polluting our public airways today. Don't allow the mass media to continue to treat you like a mindless consumer drone. Enhance your awareness. Indulge your critical thinking, your reasoning, and your analysis. Do as I do. Log on, listen in, and then let it be known all about your internet radio experience. Chimatep, beloved family, thank you for listening. Walk in light.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com, or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's IRELEND Place, Suite 109, Amityville, AMITYVILLE, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support. You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned. Our guest on today's program is Professor Mainu Ampem, who is an author. He's a historian. He focuses on primary research. He's the director of Advancing the Research. He has written several books, and he has a book coming out very shortly about Martin Luther King Jr., The Evolution of a Revolutionary. And in addition to his research, in addition to his teaching, his lecturing, and his writing, he also conducts tours, and he has one coming up in 2012, the Ethiopian tour, and we'll talk to him about that very shortly. He's also known as a pioneer in internet radio because he was with Neil Blake on the Blake Radio Network and Africana Studies, a very popular program on Rainbow Soul. So welcome, brother. How are you?
Thank you, brother. Glad to be here. All's going well.
Good, good. You talk a lot about primary research, and you're an historian, a researcher, and an author. Explain to our listeners what primary research is and what is the significance of it, particularly given that you've exposed some fraud and some shenanigans in terms of Western so-called academia.
Well, I appreciate it, Brother Junior. So that's one of the critical questions that we really look at the highest level of research, which is primary or first-hand research. And what I do and what I've been trained to do is to go directly to the sites and sources to have direct experience. So that involves going out in the field, going to pyramid sites, tomb sites, temple sites, and also ancient residential sites. And not only the field work, but also work in the libraries, looking at manuscripts and archives. So really primary research involves doing work and research going directly to the source as opposed to looking at other people's interpretations and then going by other people's conclusions and opinions. That's okay, but the primary researcher, the first-hand researcher, goes directly to the source because that's how we're able to have the most accurate, in-depth understanding. And so I've done work throughout the U.S. and North America and 19 other countries to do first-hand research because the goal is really to reconstruct the African historical experience. And we really suffer from historical amnesia, so I've been inspired to follow in the footsteps of people like Chancellor Williams and William Leo Hansberry and others who were pioneers in doing archival and library work before they've done extensive field work in Africa. So that's been my work for the past couple of decades.
What do you say to young people who are disinterested in history and don't see the significance of righting the wrongs? I mean, who have bought into this notion of post-racial America and who aren't unconcerned about our true history?
Well, you know, brother, that's a question that's always there. So, I mean, every semester at Contra Costa College here in Northern California, I have about 250 students every semester, and the vast majority of people take my class because it's a requirement in order to get their degree. And so many of them would not take the class if they didn't have to. And so when I kind of survey the class the first day, most really don't have, as you suggest, much interest in learning history, and they don't like it. And I tell them that I pretty much had a disinterest as well. And I also tell the students that really they don't necessarily dislike history. They dislike the perspective that they've been given because it's not only been abstract history as it is for most students in public schools, abstract English, abstract math, but even when African people are mentioned, it's usually a negative reference. So really what students are faced with is either they're omitted from the discussion altogether as if black students and black people have never done anything in the world, so it's a systematic omission, and then when they are included, it's usually a negative reference. So we've been oftentimes the object of somebody else's contempt when we look at history, as opposed to the subject of our own study. So really, when you put students in the midst of the of their own experience and make them the subject, then they're excited. And often in my classes, one student after another, they often have what I call did you know conversations. In other words, when they leave the classroom, they're going out and sharing what we learn with friends, family members, colleagues, and neighbors, because they're inspired and they're energized, because they understand that what had been given to them before has been a false presentation of the historical record. And so when we take them to the inside and make them the subject, that's when young people are energized. And it's not only African-American students, there's other students. I get all kinds of students in my class, and they're inspired one by one to learn more and to go to the sources. And what I also find is that they're more serious about their other classes, because I'm showing them the relevance of knowing what has happened in the past in order to illuminate the present. And that's relevant in any field, not just history. So that's been my experience, is that when you change the focal point, then you always add energy and life to the student who is usually sitting around like a bump on a log if it's the old outrageous anti-black presentation that has nothing to do with the record, when black people are left out and separated from their own contributions to the world. And once we move away from that old propaganda, then you usually have an energized student.
What you're talking about can be very unsettling, not just for, say, Euro-Americans or Europeans, but for African people who have internalized the lies that you just referred to. So how do you go about making this revelation more palatable to them? You know, because a lot of times people are just skeptical about what we say has happened to our people and what we've accomplished in the past, because this culture just does not perpetuate the truth in terms of the contributions of non-Western people. So how do you get people to move beyond their skepticism to embrace the truth?
Well, I think when we really present objective evidence. So this is why every day I'm showing images and showing the actual records and giving this material to students and having them do assignments around the text. So, like, for example, tomorrow in the U.S. history class, we are going to be dealing with one of the greatest criminals in the last few hundred years, Columbus. And so I'm giving them his journal, what he actually wrote, what mm-hmm. he said, so mm-hmm. anybody can verify the man's criminal actions back in 1492 when he took his first of four journeys to the U.S. So then when I'm explaining to students that Columbus went from being celebrated, because in 1992, some of the listeners may know who's a little bit older, that in 1992 this was the big celebration of the quincentennial celebration of Columbus's first voyage. In other words, the 500-year anniversary, which was coming up in October of 1992, but Native American activists and scholars and African scholars and writers challenged this idea. How do you celebrate Columbus given the fact that he instituted systematic slavery in the Americas and also inaugurated or began the trade of Africans across the Atlantic? So this international Western Hemisphere celebration went from a celebration to only a commemoration. Folks said, you can't commemorate this man. I mean, you can't celebrate him. You can only commemorate that he did travel. So it went from a celebration to a commemoration to ultimately a condemnation. And so when I'm explaining that to students, then when they're looking at the man's journal, then it's pretty it's pretty impactful that they can read what he wrote, and then they can see that all of the celebrations in the past, and then it makes no sense, but it comes up, and we have to put in context, well, who would continue to embrace a man with such a criminal past. I said, well, look, let's face it. How are you going to stop Columbus, Ohio, or the city of Columbus, Georgia, named after Columbus, from having some city celebrations? You have people that are locked into the past regardless of who suffered. And so when we explain these things, it makes sense to students because usually it's never presented that way. It's just we learn about him sailing on the Nina, the Pinta, Santa Maria, and that's it. He discovered America. But when we explain the details that he discovered America, America discovered him, confused, disoriented, and washed up man in one part of the world and thought he was in another part of the world and died confused, thinking he had found a new route to India, which he did not. So it's easy for students to relate to that because they all have heard of Columbus. Now when they read his journal, it makes an indelible imprint on them. And that's just one example that we'll be covering this week. But it's in one situation after another when we provide the actual documents, show the students the artifacts, and then also encourage them to go to the local museums. Or if I'm doing a presentation on campus, which I may do once or twice a semester, so that students can not only they see me every day in class and every week, but when we have a larger seminar, now they can see the bigger picture when we have community people to come out and also they can see the reaction of not only other students but other faculty members and administrators on campus who also are uninformed. So it helps to see students that they're learning information that many people don't know, and that further inspires them to want to know more. And that's why I get a pretty fair number of students that not only take additional classes of mine, even though history or Africana studies may not be their major, but they want to know more. But some of them actually make it a major, too, because they either switch majors or they'll add an additional major because they can see the relevance in the fields of Africana study and his studies in history in general. So I found that to be the case in one semester after another. There's always a pretty significant number of students who are inspired by what they've learned.
Mm-hmm. Well, when they look at Columbus's journal and they see his writings, correct me if I'm in error, but they see in his writings where he saw Africans rowing across the Atlantic, what's their take on that? I mean, because that further just demolishes the whole myth that he was this solitary explorer who was on this great quest and he'd made this great discovery when he himself saw black people coming and going on several of his voyages.
Yeah, that's crucial. You know, and actually, so I've actually prepared them by looking at West Africa, looking at Ghana, Mali, Songhe, and the great Timbuktu tradition. And so we've looked at that as well as African voyages to the Americas before Columbus. And so next week when we look at Columbus's journal, they also will be there was an interview that Ivan Van Sertima did about 20 years ago where he looked at seven different categories of evidence that shows that Africans came to the Americas long before Columbus. And one of those seven categories is eyewitness testimony, where Van Sertima chronicles 12 Europeans that said that they saw Africans in the Americas when they first came, or that they were told that Africans were there in the area by the local Native Americans. And these Europeans were the first conquistadors, starting with Columbus and others, the first ones to introduce slavery. Columbus is the first conquistador to introduce slavery. Then you have others who came over, whether it's Balboa or Cortez, mm-hmm. and others. And mm-hmm. and in each case, you have in various parts of the Caribbean and Central America, you name it, you have one account after another, including two accounts by Columbus himself that Africans were already here. So that's part of the story that that I put into the lesson, because students need to know that it makes no sense for somebody to be arguing that the first Africans came as enslaved people, and that mm-hmm. anytime you see Africans, they were fugitives who had ran away. I said, it makes no sense. How could they be running away from slavery when slavery didn't even exist when they were here? Because the first enslavers, Columbus and others, said that they saw Africans already here. So the fugitive slave theory makes no sense because it's not supported by evidence. And so, you know, from day one, it's really asking students to focus on not only the documents and first-hand evidence, but critical thinking.
Right.
And, you know, also,
right.
Brother, too, one of the things at the community college level that I'm teaching, we get students from any and all backgrounds. So I have students that are not only the so-called traditional age, you know, maybe 19 to 25, but we have students quite a bit older, and they're in late 20s, 30s. Well, I have a number of grandparents in my class, and so these are returning students who have to remake their careers, get a degree, and then I have some that are just taking the classes for the cultural enrichment because they want to know more about the society that they live in. And so we get a number of students. Some are pretty young and they don't know much about anything, but then there's a number of students in my class that are very knowledgeable, and they help to keep the standards high because they're very serious. They bring something to class, and I'm taking what they know to a different level. And so I think we've done a pretty decent job at giving students a completely different perspective than what they've been given in the past, because the rule in primary research, the rule is that documentation beats conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk all day, but let's look at the documentation. And I keep my door open, so what I tell them is what I tell a body of specialists as well, because the information doesn't change at all. I mean, it is what it is, and so it's hard for anybody to impeach what is objective evidence, and that's what I share with them, is that we must be impeccable in our research. We must be rigorous so that we're not just making statements today that we have to change tomorrow because we didn't do our homework.
Well, one of the things that obviously you're doing is teaching them critical thinking skills, which are sorely needed in this culture, because I use the phrase dumbed down, and our young people in particular, but the populace in general, is being just bamboozled every day with the what I call the corporate mind control apparatus. So in your way, you're being very seditious to bring down that apparatus, you know, little by little, because the only way you can do it is have people think for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You're right, brother. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in a lot of the writings that you distribute, I'm sorry, on a regular basis, that's, you know, the kind of contemporary things that are happening. And that's also some things that I bring up with students, so it's not just something that they might see as a distant, unconnected past,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but that things are very real, very relevant. You know, like you have a lot of, like here in California, there are students that have been organizing and rallying behind the increasing tuition cost and the cutting of classes and cutting of faculty and the cutting of support services, such as in the library or counseling and all kind of other services. And so for them to understand that, so as long as the country is spending billions and billions of dollars every single month to go kill somebody abroad, then we're not going to have money. So for them to make the connection, and then so it depends on what class it is, I can focus on this in great detail. We look at the historical development of U.S. imperialism. So I have another class, that's where we ended up. It's a section on the quest for empire. This is what the last 150
mm-hmm,
years
mm-hmm.
in the U.S., this section. So, you know, to make it relevant, I put students in the here and now so that we can make connections to the past, so it's not just some old, tired information that doesn't have any relevance today. But I make sure that they know that what we're discussing in the past is real and relevant to the present, and it affects their current situation. And not to know that is naive and foolish.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things you're doing is conducting a tour of Ethiopia, and you're calling it the Ancient Kush Tour. Now, clarify something, because a lot of people interchange Nubia, Kush, Punt, and Kemet. Is there a distinction, and or is it a continuous, you know, because Chekhov Diop felt that, that there is and always has been a cultural dynamism and a cultural synthesis and cohesion throughout the continent. So are you in agreement with that, or is there, you know, typical boundaries that as we come to know it in West, you know, with the nation state concept?
Okay, I appreciate that question. Yeah, I'm leading a tour this May and June to Ethiopia, and I call it Ethiopia, the Land of Ancient Kush Tour. And so I've been leading those tours every summer, educational tours, and part of the goal is not just the educational tours for 2 weeks, but also to expose people to the origins of high-level civilization in the Nile Valley, because I'm starting to do field research in the area, and I need more people that are exposed and familiar and from that group that are interested in also doing field work. But these are different civilizations in the northeast corridor of Africa along the Nile Valley. The oldest of these civilizations is actually Kush, usually spelled K-U-S-H. Every now and then, like in the biblical context, you might see it with C-U-S-H. Mm-hmm. But Kush is the oldest name, and it goes far back into antiquity. But this is the oldest of the what we call the classical African civilizations. And Kush, the political center was in current-day Sudan. That's where the heartland of ancient Kush was. But it was a very expansive empire, so it included current-day Sudan, current-day Egypt, Somalia, Djibouti, Eritrea, but also on the other side of the Red Sea, including Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
This was Kush going back to the most earliest days. We don't have a specific time period in which Kush emerged, because the further we go back, as Dr. Chancellor Williams indicates, it seems to be ready-made. We don't see any period of development. It's a highly developed, highly sophisticated culture the further we go back. And in this vast empire, a civilization that emerged later to the north is Nubia. And Nubia is northern Sudan and also southern Egypt. That's the region of ancient Nubia. And so the Nubian civilization emerged from the greater Kushite Empire. And then after Nubia, then finally even further north in what we call current-day Egypt, there's a civilization of Kemet emerged about. The dates are questionable, but mainstream people would say that the first dynasty or family of rulers in Kemet would have emerged about 5,000 years ago or 3,100 or so before the Common Era. So these are actually distinctive civilizations, distinct African civilizations. However, most mainstream so-called authorities or Egyptologists, they completely mix Kush and Nubia together. I was meeting with a group earlier. There's people to support my field work. They here in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area, they form, and I work with them and meet with them, but they form the Kush-Nubia work study group so that they're studying this in order to help to support the field work and other projects we have. But basically, that's what I was explaining to them earlier, that if you look at, you can look at a painting in one so-called scholarly source, and it would say from Kush, and look at the same painting in another scholarly source, and it would say a painting from Nubia. But that's the problem. There's been so little serious field work that's been done in the heartland of Kush that you have people that specialize in the area that are thoroughly confused, and that's why they mix and mingle Kush and Nubia with no understanding at all. But these are distinct civilizations, and there are search, there's certain sources of information that, or categories of information that we can look at in order to know more about it. And one is the archaeological records. That's one critical source of information, is records from Kemet that help us to know more about ancient Kush. There's also the critical information from Greek and Roman writers, and then there's also museum evidence as well. But there's artifacts in museums. So there's different categories of first-hand sources that we really can consult to learn more about Kush, and that's why the ongoing work is so crucial to know more about the powerful influence of Kush that emerged in Northeast Africa many millennia ago.
Now, part of your tour is field research training. Now, do you have to sign up for that distinctively to participate, or is that part of the overall tour?
Yeah, it's part of the overall tour.
What does that entail?
What do you say? Sorry.
What does that entail? How, you know, you're actually showing people, you go to sites and you show them how to look for evidence and look for remains and artifacts?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, teaching them the basic techniques and rules and tools that a specialist uses in the field. So like we had a group last year out of the group. The numbers may vary, but on this group we had a handful, about four or five people that were really serious about knowing all of the techniques that a researcher would use, as well as some basic rules of thumb. Because generally, you know, people go to the sites, they might hear an explanation, they take a couple pictures, and that's about it. But for the researcher, it's more than that. Like if I'm going to a site, and a lot of times the sites, particularly like maybe if you're looking at the most ancient sites in Ethiopia, Sudan, in those areas you're not going to see, in some cases, there are some phenomenal sites, like in Sudan, there's hundreds of pyramids, mm-hmm. but there are also some sites in Sudan, also in Ethiopia, where you don't see that. So you have to then shift. And what helps in the field is having a thorough knowledge of the written sources. Because when somebody looks at the written sources and some of the ancient records, then you really know what to expect in the field or what it used to be like. And so one of the telltale signs that somebody's in a rich archaeological site is not always the grand structures, but pot fragments,
mm-hmm.
pot shards.
Mm-hmm.
When the area is littered with fragments of pots, you know it was a rich archaeological area. So that's where you go. You follow that trail. And when you follow the trails of pot fragments, usually that will lead you to a very important structure that still might be half buried. That's how I found the central axis of different temples, and because you're not going to really see them, because you have in these regions you have, you know, many different land
mm-hmm.
forms
mm-hmm.
And dust and wind and so many other debris, so you have to look for these different signs, but it's different things to look for. So when people actually are walking around, they usually walk by some critical information. It might be images on really small doorways. It could be a doorway to something, and the average person are looking in the door to see what's inside, and it's kind of a natural reaction. But very few people would stop at the door frame and look and see what images or inscriptions are there. So I had mentioned that to folks, but that was just kind of word. So I let them go into one of the structures. This is in Ethiopia this past summer. And I said, okay, now look, y'all made a critical mistake. I want everybody to come back out. Let me show you something. And I showed them some old images of Africoid. And this was actually in Ethiopia. This was in Lalibela, one of the important Christian sites there. And I showed them that there were some Africoid images that they had overlooked, an early Christian images of some Africoid images with the fro and the unmistakable African features on the doorway that they had missed, and they were stunned that they were right there, almost at eye level. So, yeah, well, once you start thinking like a researcher, these things are so automatic. But when you're just a average person, just excited about the experience, and you're not going through it with a methodological approach, you're going to miss most things. But there's a lot of principles to share with people out in the field, and that's why I love being there, because that's the larger classroom where we're hands-on and really show people what things are like in the field and start to show patterns. Because once people can understand patterns and have somewhat of a foundation based on the reading beforehand, then that work in the field is rewarding, because we know that we are reconstructing the past. So those who want to take it to that level, it's exciting. And also, too, Brother Junius, one of the things that's interesting that I found that when we have days where it's really hands-on in any kind of adventure, people seem to remember that most. I mean, even in Kemet, for example, I mean, it happens in Ethiopia, but in Kemet, it's kind of amazing, because with the great structures, the great pyramids of Giza, the great Heru Imaket, or the great Sphinx, and all these tremendous monuments, and then we go to so many other sites up and down Kemet, dozens of sites. When we discussed the tour at the end of the 2-week experience and what stood out the most, what's interesting is that a large number of people indicate that to them one of the highlights of the trip is when we went to a site called Meidum, and I took them into an old tomb structure where they had to crawl in and climb down this shaky, halfway unstable ladder, and then crawl over the plank, and then really get dirty to walk in, or not walk, but to crawl in and get into a place where it's a sarcophagus in there. I mean, you would think that how would that compare to some of the greatest monuments on earth? But people can now have a more hands-on understanding of what a researcher would have to do to find things. And it's going into that space of having to descend 180 feet in a small opening to go inside of a pyramid. I mean, this is the kind of things that stand out for some of the visitors. Some of the people want to know more than the actual grand structures themselves. So it's always interesting to see what stood out for the people on the trip. But people, for me, it's always exciting to know that there are always people want to contribute to the research, and they want to know how to conduct this kind of research.
How can people get more information about the tour? Now, the tour is from May 31st to June 13th. 2012. So how can people get more information about it?
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, we're coming up on a deadline for the tour, so people can actually call me directly, which is at 510-568-3880. That's 510-568-3880. And to get more information. And also, if people go directly to my website, which is maynuampim.com.
Right, spell that so they can go get that correct.
Okay, M-A-N-U, and last name Ampim, that's A-M-P-I-M.com. And on the home page is the brochure for the trip to Ethiopia, May 31st to June 13th. And so the deadline to register for the tour, obviously this is already March, so we don't have much time, but the deadline is the 22nd of this month. So we have less than 2 weeks for those that are interested in perhaps joining us for the Ethiopia tour this summer.
Now, when you go, you're staying in good hotels, you promise two meals a day, you're doing the field research training, you're also giving them lectures in the evening. So in addition to all that, what else can they expect when they go on this tour?
There's three things that really, we actually, for this tour, it's we go to the northern sites. People in Ethiopia call it the historic route, so that we go to to the historic sites in the north. And in going to those sites in the north, there's really three main themes. And one theme is that on the tour, people learn about the old civilization of ancient Kush. Ancient Kush and ancient Aksum, these the more ancient civilizations before colonization and before foreigners introduced anything new and really disrupted ancient African civilizations in that region, which included Ethiopia. So one theme is to look at ancient Kush. Another theme is also the origins of humanity, because some of the oldest human remains have been found right there in the Ethiopian region.
Mm-hmm.
And in Addis Ababa, in the capital, we go to the National Museum, and they have a section in the museum dealing with Lucy and Salaam and some of the oldest remains and the development of modern humanity. So that's another theme. And then a more recent theme is the Christian influence as well. That's pretty prominent because in the north, most of the people are Orthodox Christian, and so a lot of the sites, you have some of the old churches and so forth, and so there's been a major influence in northern Ethiopia. So those are the three themes that people will learn about along the way, and then also be able to learn about the highly refined culture in Ethiopia and the character, because you can tell by how the people interact that they that it's a polite culture, that you don't see people yelling back and forth
mm-hmm.
at each other 3 feet away as we would normally see in Egypt, for example. You know, you have people speaking Arabic, and if somebody doesn't know the culture, you think that every conversation is an argument, that somebody's getting ready to fight in Egypt, because it just seems to be so aggressive. People are stunned by that. But then you contrast that with Ethiopia, when people are speaking Amharic, that's the national language, although people speak other languages there as well, because there's about 83 ethnic groups in Ethiopia. But when people are speaking Amharic and other languages, it's so polite. It's so calm. A lot of times when they're speaking among themselves, you can barely hear what they're saying because it's such a calm interaction. And you can see that these people come from a highly developed culture, because if not, you would see that they would be certainly more aggressive or have other areas in their conduct that would indicate that they've, you know, the background that they've come from. So people see that, and of course, you know, the world famous Ethiopian food is can never really be outdone. So there's many things that people learn, and but they also know that in the midst of all of that, at the same time, the country really is in many areas it hasn't developed very much. I mean, if you leave the capital of Addis Ababa, you just don't have much development. So in the south of Ethiopia is when you have, and not, I shouldn't just say the south, but in the south and other areas, there's just not a lot of development because the Western powers have made it their business
mm-hmm.
to control
the area. You put a chokehold on it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's
now, I was going to ask you, because of the Western mischief in that region, in the Horn of Africa, is there any reticence on your part to take tours there, because there have been problems, you know, in many ways the Ethiopian government is a proxy for the West, for their mischief in the region. So people want to know that they're safe and secure. So, you know, can you put any fears that people might have to rest?
Yeah, and you know, that's a valid point that you make. Because when somebody sees something on CNN or any other source that they happen to trust, that they're not looking at alternative news, and they would think that the world is unsafe everywhere, other than you know, maybe some place like Europe or something like that. And so, you know, the way the media presents it seems as though, man, it is totally unsafe. So I always tell people a couple things. One is I live in Oakland, number one, and the college is in Richmond, California. Many people may not know the reputation of Richmond, but they'll shoot them up in a minute in Richmond, just like they'll shoot you down here if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong crowd. So I tell people, I live in Oakland, I work in Richmond, what else you want me to say? And so I feel safer. I mean, literally, I feel safer in those regions than I do here. I'm more at risk here. And then I also tell people that in addition to that, that I'm not a tour agent. I'm a tour leader. So in other words, I don't just book somebody, book a group's tour and say, you know, have a good trip.
Yeah,
see
right.
you when you get back. I'm with them. So I have no reason to overlook anything because I'm there as well. So if nothing else, my safety is important here. So I let people know that. There's no tour agent just sending you in some. Well, I'm there in the trenches. So, but you know, in all honesty, there's always people, brother, that will convince themselves it ain't safe. They're not going to go, and they'll make that decision without getting any information or without checking with me to see what I would have to say about their concerns and so forth. So really, there's always people who say, nope, I won't do it. But then there's others who take the step to at least inquire and get another point of view other than what they might hear about in the mainstream media, because as you, you know, pretty much suggest, is that you got Western mischief and nonsense and Western interest in the region. So it is in their interest to make it seem like the area is unstable. So when they go in with troops or kill somebody or have an influence, oh, yeah, well, we need to control those so-called terrorists or take down some terrorist government or some dictator. So they promote this so that it prepares the public for the next stage of U.S. actions. And a lot of this is complete propaganda that has little to do with the real facts. But the bottom line is all these things that people hear and see on our end, most of it, the local people don't know anything about this. Like I was telling people today, and also I was at a conference this weekend in Nevada, and these are educators that asked me about Sudan, and I said that well the reality is the people in the capital of Khartoum, many of them did not know, and I don't mean just some people sleeping on the street, but these are regular everyday people that did not know that there was a war in Darfur in the western part of the country, and those that did know didn't care because it had no impact, really.
Right.
It had no material impact on their life. So I was telling people, say, we are no more and are more concerned about Darfur than many. I wouldn't say all, but many of the people, and I would say the majority is probably accurate, many of the people in the capital of Khartoum. So it's interesting how the media influences people to think that some local conflicts are more larger than what they are. And I don't mean to suggest that the killings in Darfur didn't happen and that this wasn't a tragedy. That's not the issue at all. My simple point is that the people in the country who didn't live in that area, the majority of them, it did not mean anything to them. Just like we live in our own city and, you know, here in Oakland, for example, those of us who are living constructive lives and working in the community and so forth, if we don't live in drug culture and involved with all that, yeah, we'll hear on the news that some folks got shot and killed this weekend, but that's not my day-to-day reality in the same city. So if that's the case, if all of us know that there are certain places and times and people that we need to stay away from in our city and generally all is good, then why would it be so difficult to understand that that's how it works in other parts of the world as well? So that's what really I tell people, you know, let's be realistic about what we may see and hear on the news and then compare that to our own personal experiences, because there's no possible way that a city can just be full 100% criminals and killers and shooters. And that's also the case that there's no way that can be the case in these countries that that everywhere you go is totally unsafe. And that's just not you know, the reality. So that's what people need to know.
Yeah, the only reason I brought it up is because we're being conditioned to be fearful. I mean, it's just a major campaign of fear mongering to keep the imperialist and military machine going. So I just want folks to know that these tours are planned, they're purposeful, and no one in their right mind would take a group of people into a hostile or unsafe environment.
Exactly, and I just want to say this quick footnote to highlight that. That's why I didn't take any groups to Kemet last year, is because, and now if it was with the Arab Spring, as people are now calling it, and it's not that it was because of me. I just knew that people were not going to be interested in going, mm-hmm. so I just said, mm-hmm. well, let's just cancel it because there was too many things going on, and I didn't really have I had limited information about the details, so that's why I canceled that. You know, so you're right. There's no reason to put people in any situation like that, and I never have and never will. But also, people should do a little homework so they know that there's always more to the news than what we might see in mainstream media.
All right, give your contact information again, and then we'll let you go. And with our gratitude, and I'd like to have you come back again to talk about some of the other things, because I, quite frankly, I miss your program on Rainbow Soul, because it's so informative and it was so thorough. And you know, when you compare that to the claptrap and the nonsense that we're fed over and over again, you know, we as a people need to get back in our right minds, and the only way we can do it is through ourselves or through our own hard work, research, or people like yourself who provide information that you don't get in the mainstream media.
Well, I appreciate it, brother. And I appreciate the opportunity as well through your network to share the work. Well, people can reach me again at my website. It's my name. It's manumpim.com, which is manumpim.com. And I have a lot of my work on the website, including the Ethiopia trip. And also could be reached at 510-568-3880, and my information is there as well as email and so forth. I'll be glad to hear from anybody. Also, I'm on Facebook, and we also put up 5 new video clips on the Kashbar Dam and the flooding of ancient Nubia, and so that's an issue that's taking place now, is the ancient Nubian mm-hmm. civilization, and there's dams.
Yeah, aren't they building a new dam there? They did one in Aswan, a little further below Aswan. Aren't they planning to do another one?
Yeah, they actually finished one in 2008, and it's called the Merowe Dam at the Fourth Cataract in northern Sudan. That one was finished in 2008, and currently, and I would say unfortunately, the Sudanese government, in conjunction with Chinese construction firms, they've already finalized the contracts to start 4 new dam projects in northern Sudan. And these dam projects, the 4 of them, they're pretty much in northern Sudan, and they're going to flood parts of ancient Kush and parts of ancient Nubia civilizations and dislocate at least 150,000 people. So this is a major, major concern that these dams would be built. And I just want folks to know this is a major campaign we're focused on. So we have a Save Nubia project, and this is not something simply coming from me. Yes, I've been out in the field to initiate the Save Nubia project, but this is to help the local people who have already been protesting. I'm talking about local Sudanese, the Nubians and the Manasir and other local groups. They don't agree. And by the way, the World Commission on Dams has said that no dam should be built anywhere in the world unless the local affected communities agree. And not only that, they should agree, that they should be a part of the the ongoing discussion of this
process. Planning. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is not done at all. So it's important for somebody for no one to get the wrong impression that we're trying to impose some outside views on what's best for local people in Sudan. No, they're the ones that have initiated the campaign, and we're supporting. So if people go to the site, they'll see, and also go to YouTube and put in my name, they can see some of the latest work around these issues.
All right, brother, I appreciate you taking the time out and being with us and sharing your extensive knowledge and just giving your background on what you're doing in the community and worldwide. Now, people can call or email you to indicate their interest, and the deadline is when?
Deadline for the Ethiopia tour is March the 22nd, so just over a week and a half from now.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope people hear about this and folks can contact you, get more information if they're so inclined. But we definitely appreciate you, and we appreciate what you're doing out there.
Well, thank you, Brother Junior. I appreciate your work also and the opportunity, Brother, to share the work with the community. Thanks so much.
Appreciate all right, man. That. Stay strong.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank
all
you,
right.
Brother. Okay.
Diverse faith is a faith that no army with artillery can raise. Where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try any.